Okay, welcome back to the introduction to modern cryptography. Where are we stuck? We are looking at symmetric encryption at the moment. Last week we looked at a bunch of different constructions. One-time pad, security one-time pad, then encryption with pseudorandom generators. Both of these constructions were just there to tell you that it is possible, first of all, unconditionally, and then from where we very weak assumptions, but also then with very useless properties. Then stream ciphers from pseudorandom functions, and then block modes of operation. We have just seen one block mode of operation, since there was too little time last week. But if you're interested in that, you can take a look at more constructions. So we've looked at electronic code book mode and cipher block chaining mode, ECB and CBC. There are more modes like output feedback mode and so on and so forth. I think for practice, everything that you need to know is summarized pretty comprehensively on Wikipedia. The idea, however, so if you want to understand why these constructions are secure, you can take a look at the book, at the Katz-Lindell book. There you also have this stated what the requirements for the underlying building blocks, for example, for the pseudorandom permutation are. The big problem that we identified at the end of last week is that if we use, for example, encryption with CBC mode, then I told you anecdotally that there are a bunch of attacks. Attacks in the sense that if encryption is used with CBC mode, then this is just IND CPA secure. So it is just secure against chosen plaintext attacks, if the attacker can only see ciphertexts for chosen messages. There are attacks against CBC mode in the IND CCA security definition. So if the attacker can actively change ciphertexts, then the CBC mode is not secure anymore. And this is not surprising, because the CBC mode was not meant to be secure against chosen ciphertext attacks. But we want to have security against chosen ciphertext attacks, because that's what happens on the internet. There are attackers that can change ciphertexts. And there are attackers that, after changing ciphertexts, can see how the victims reacted to these ciphertexts. One example that I repeat telling you is that if an attacker, for example, against two WhatsApp users, WhatsApp user A, WhatsApp user B, and the attacker basically produces a ciphertext, sends the ciphertext to Bob, to B, and Bob decrypts it, thinking that the ciphertext was sent by Alice, receives the message, something is displayed, it looks like garbage because the attacker may not be able to produce a valid looking ciphertext that decrypts to something meaningful, then one of the reactions of Bob could be to post that in a WhatsApp status. And then everybody else in their contact book, in their address book, would see this WhatsApp status, and maybe one of the users in the address book of Bob is actually connected to the attacker. And so suddenly the attacker, first of all, was able to produce a ciphertext, let Bob decrypt that ciphertext, and then also learn what the message in that ciphertext looked like. This is a super strong type of reaction. We talked about other forms of chosen ciphertext attacks where attackers can see less information about the reaction. For example, there can be timing side channels. It might be that when an attacker sends something to the Wikipedia server, so the attacker produces some ciphertext, sends it to the Wikipedia server, and maybe the produced ciphertext is a slightly changed very end of the ciphertext that actually I sent at some point when I wanted to know something from Wikipedia. And then the attacker just observes how long does it take for Wikipedia to respond to that ciphertext. And maybe the response time depends on the payload. And so maybe the response is just the message that was decrypted looked good or it looked bad. So it's maybe just one bit that the attacker learns. But this is already a reaction that the attacker can observe. So we want to have security against active adversaries. And as long as we talk about symmetric cryptography, authentication means, and security against active attacks means that we want to have authentication and integrity. And authentication, and this is what we look at today, means that we want to build something like message authentication codes that protect the integrity of information, or we want to directly integrate this level of integrity and authenticity into encryption. And then we call this type of primitive authenticated encryption. This was the introduction. So let's look at authenticated encryption. No, let's look at message authentication codes first. So message authentication codes. Also called MAC. And you can find more information in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 107 and following. So what's the idea of message authentication codes? We have users Alice and Bob, and we have an adversary on the wire. And this adversary tries to manipulate messages sent from Alice to messages received by Bob. Now the idea is that Alice and Bob, they already share some symmetric key. And they use the symmetric key to compute a tag. So Alice has an algorithm tag, TAG. She uses the symmetric key and her message, and the output is some tag, and the symbol that we use for tags is tau. And Alice sends the tag over the channel. Now the adversary changes the message. Maybe it also makes sense for the adversary to change the tag. Now Bob doesn't know, is this message really sent from Alice? Was this message sent by Alice, was it unchanged? And in order to verify that, Bob now has a verify algorithm that takes as input the symmetric key K, the received message M prime, and the received tag tau prime. And this verify algorithm either outputs 0 or 1. And if it outputs 1, then everything is fine. Bob knows this thing has really been sent by Alice. If it is 0, then Bob knows something has been changed. Something has been manipulated. This message wasn't really sent from Alice. So the syntax of this primitive is just what I just described. We have a gen algorithm that on input nothing outputs a symmetric key. We have a tag algorithm and the tag algorithm on input of a key element and a message element randomly outputs a tag. And the verify algorithm when input the key, a message, and a tag, either outputs 0 or 1. That's pretty straightforward. What about correctness? How do we define correctness following the scheme from last week's? Yes, so the probability that the verification of the key and a message and the tag that was produced with that key and a message should be 1. For all keys that were honestly generated, and all messages in the message space. So we just hop through our 5 steps of defining security. Step 1 and step 2, finished. Step 3. What is step 3 in defining security? Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
What is in message space? Is it all the messages till this time, or is it all the possibilities of the messages?
Second version, yes. The message space, just like the key space or the tag space. So these symbols here, they indicate spaces. They are written in LaTeX, they are written in the same font as our adversaries. Some calligraphic K, some calligraphic M, some calligraphic tau, T, whatever. And the output space of the verify algorithm is just a bit. So it's 1 or 0. And the message space is just the space of all possible messages that can be tagged and verified with the particular message authentication code. So, what's the third step of defining security, as we've learned it in the second lecture? Step 1, syntax. Step 2, correctness. Step 3? What, just intuitively, you don't need to come up with the keyword. It's about what do we want to define for security? Yes, please. We want to define a game-based definition, but that's our tool. That's our methodology, or that's our framework in which we do it. But if we want to cover security as we want to as we would like to have it in practice, what aspects from practice do we want to cover? There are 2 aspects that we want to cover. Yes, please. Exactly. So the 2 things, they are not directly related to each other. They can be defined pretty much independently. We want to define what can an attacker do. These are the capabilities. So an attacker on the internet can basically do everything, can manipulate things, can observe things, and so on and so forth. And the security goal is, what does the attacker want to achieve, or what do we want to prevent? So the first thing is adversarial capabilities. The adversarial capabilities that we define for message authentication codes are so-called chosen message attacks. CMA. And the security goal there are two possible security goals. Just as with one-way and IND security, we define strong and normal or existential unforgeability and UIF is sometimes also called existential unforgeability. Depending on what paper you look at, you will see strong unforgeability or only unforgeability or existential unforgeability, and existential unforgeability and normal unforgeability is the same. So, to continue with our form of defining security with boxes and arrows, we define strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks for a message authentication code and attacker A. And attacker A is on the right side here. So what could chosen message attacks mean? Or put differently, what type of capabilities would we allow an attacker to do, to perform, when trying to break the security of a MAC? To have any arbitrary message authenticated, exactly. So our game internally begins with generating a key, and then the attacker can send arbitrary messages, and our game internally tags these messages with the internal key. Then the attacker gets back the message tags or the MAC tags. The attacker can repeat this multiple times. And we call this the Oracle tag that on input of a message outputs a tag. What else would we want an attacker to do? Or simultaneously, what could be the goal of the attacker? Yes, please. He could try to verify a message, exactly. So, what would be the input to such an oracle?
A message and a tag,
and we call this MJ and tau J. And the attacker can do this multiple times. And the reason why we allow this an attacker to do is that maybe the attacker tries to produce valid tags. And as we've seen it for encryption, it's pretty reasonable that an attacker learns something about whether a tag was valid or not. So the attacker may produce a message and a tag and sends it to Bob. And then Bob, maybe if the tag is accepted, will respond to Alice. If the tag is rejected, Bob maybe never does something. And this reaction is already sufficient to learn for an attacker or to learn by an attacker that a message tag has been, or a MAC tag has been correct. So, once the game receives such a query, it executes the verify algorithm on input of the key, the message, and the tag, and it outputs some result delta j. Now, under which conditions would the attacker be successful? Yes, please.
The attacker can challenge with an N star, tau star, such that verify of them is one.
They would be successful. Okay, so let's leave two blank lines here and then slightly aligned we write that if delta j equals one, then we stop with one. Now, what is the fifth step of defining security?
To define the trivial attacks.
Okay, so what could be a trivial attack? And we will see in a second that there are two different forms of trivial attacks. The first one is for unforgeability, and the second one is for strong unforgeability. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, we start with strong unforgeability and we do bookkeeping here. So, in a set Q, we collect all the message tag pairs that we produce as the challenger. And then, so what would be the if statement? If yes, exactly. Not in Q. Then we continue. Okay, so this is strong unforgeability for chosen message attacks. There is nothing to add here. We are happy. The property that we see protected by strong unforgeability is that the message authentication code actually protects both the message, but also the tag itself. So it should be hard, even if the attacker has seen a message or seen a tag for a certain message, then it should still be hard for the attacker to come up with a different tag for that same message. And it turns out that building message authentication codes that provide this level of security are slightly harder, sometimes at least, and in particular, if we look at signatures later, it's at asymmetric cryptography, than building tags that only protect the integrity of the message and not the tag itself. So how could we specify a security definition that only protects the integrity of the messages and not also of the tags? which would be unforgeability and not strong unforgeability. How could we relax the definition? How could we make the attacker slightly stronger in the sense that more type of attacks are valid, such that only messages are protected, or only the integrity of messages are protected? Yes, please. No worries.
Every time we create an message, we also collect that. There's a big message space, and if our last created message is not in this space, then it's not generated.
Okay, that would be fine. So we could just collect the messages that the attacker saw, and we don't collect the tags. And that is actually what I would like to cover here. But I don't want to change my bookkeeping, so I just want to write down a different if statement, if clause. Yes, please.
If there exists no tag,
if there exists a tag prime such that message J, comma, tag prime if there exists no. If there exists no tag prime such that message J, comma, tag prime is in Q, then we continue. Okay, so the advantage that we define for message authentication codes regarding the strong or normal unforgeability game under chosen message attacks for an adversary A is defined as the probability that the strong or normal unforgeability game under chosen message attacks for the MAC and adversary A equals 1. And it is not complicated to prove that strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks implies existential unforgeability under chosen message attacks, and it's also not complicated to prove that the other way around does not hold. Okay, so now we know what the goal is. We know how to build, no, we don't know how to build it yet. This is the next step. So, constructions. First of all, we have the so-called HMAC. We've seen the HMAC in the second week, or basically in the first week and the second session. Then there are constructions like the so-called GMAC, or Pauli 1305, and these two are based on differential universal function, difference universal function. And if you're interested, you can just take a look at the book, but this goes deep into algebraic ideas that I don't want to introduce here. And we can also build it information theoretically secure. Which basically means that we don't need any underlying assumptions. So it's unconditional. Just as a reminder, the only two things that we will see in this course that are unconditionally or that can be built unconditionally secure is the one-time pad and message authentication codes. Everything else needs assumptions. Everything else needs script analysts that tell us this is a good assumption, this is a bad assumption. A simple construction that we can use to build message authentication codes is from pseudorandom functions. And you can see more about that in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 116 and following. The gen algorithm for this message authentication code based on pseudorandom function is just sampling a random key from the PRF's key space, and it returns that key. The tag algorithm on input of the key and the message, what does that do? Does anybody have an idea how we could use pseudorandom functions to build a message authentication code? So, this is the point in this lecture where we all together think. We start thinking. What was the goal of a message authentication code? The goal of a message authentication code was to make sure that it should be hard for an attacker to come up with a valid, verifiable tag for a message. How could a pseudorandom function give us this property? Seconds or maybe 20 seconds of thinking. Maybe as a starter, what does a pseudorandom function do again? What's the guarantee that a pseudorandom function gives us? Thank you. Very good. Very good summary of what a pseudorandom function is. A pseudorandom function, just as a repetition, takes as input a key and some associated data, and it outputs an output deterministically that is indistinguishable from a random string, from a random key, from a random output value. Now, how could that be useful for building a message authentication code? So we just define the output of the tag as the output of the pseudorandom function on input of the key and the message. But interestingly, and this makes it interesting, it is great to have a message authentication code with random looking tags. But unforgeability doesn't require that tags are random. So we see here, and we will just prove that, or at least have a sketch of the proof, that this form of building a tag is sufficient. So we can use pseudo-random functions to build a message authentication code. But if it was necessary, then we would know a way to build pseudo-random functions unconditionally. Because we have seen, I just at least told you, that we can build message authentication codes unconditionally without assumptions. But we have also seen that pseudo-random functions imply pseudo-random generators, and pseudo-random generators imply one-way functions, and the other way around. So if we would, and this was the only part in your statement that was not entirely correct, it's not necessary that the output of a tag, or that a tag of message authentication code looks random, because if it was necessary, then pseudo-random functions would be equivalent to message authentication codes, and if they were equivalent, then we would have a proof that we can build one-way functions unconditionally, and we don't have that proof. So, that was just a bit nerd content. What's the verification algorithm? How does the verification algorithm look like? Maybe someone who didn't say anything today so far. How does the verification algorithm for the Mac that uses the pseudo-random function look like? Just as a reminder, the verify algorithm as input takes a key, a message, and a tag. Yes, please.
Function of the key and the message prime as the received message.
Yeah.
And compares the result with the received tag.
Exactly. It returns whether f of k comma m equals the input tag tau. So the security intuitively requires or says that the message authentication code is strongly unforgeable under chosen message attacks if the pseudorandom function is IND secure. Now, let's try to sketch the proof. And for sketching the proof, we use something that we talked about last week in the lecture, last week in the exercise, which is a sequence of games. So, game zero. What is game zero again? How does game zero look like? Yes, please. Which one is it? Okay, so it's the SUF, the so-called original game, so original SUF CMA game for our construction from above. So the attacker in game zero plays the SUF CMA game against this construction. Now we changed this game a little bit. And does anybody have an idea of how we could change the game meaningfully? The idea is that if an attacker identifies the difference, then we can use this attacker to break the IND security of the PRF. It's identical to game 0 except so we want to change game 0 just a tiny little bit in a way such that we can still simulate the game and that we can write an extractor that would take a distinguisher between game 0 and game 1 that successfully identifies in which game it plays to break the IND security of the PRF. Exactly. So, the idea of a pseudorandom function, as a reminder, is that the output of the pseudorandom function looks random. And the security guarantee is that an attacker that can identify whether the output of a pseudorandom function was really computed or randomly sampled should be unsuccessful. So when we want to use this security guarantee that the output of a PRF looks independent or indistinguishable from a randomly sampled output, then we can use that here to actually do this. The only property is that whenever we compute the same tag, whenever we compute the tag for the same message, we have to output the same tag. So we have to do some bookkeeping, but that's the only thing that we have to do. So, identical to game 0, except that mag tags for different messages are randomly sampled. Reduction. So, again, funny guessing game. What are the three boxes that we have here? What do they do? What is their purpose? How do they interact with each other? Yes, please. No. Yes, please. Perfect, thank you. Almost. The interesting part here is now we use this sequence of game technique that we have seen in the exercise 2 weeks ago. And the idea here is not to have a direct reduction from one to another, but that we have a reduction that uses a distinguisher that sits between the two games that we specified, game 0 and game 1, and tries to identify which one it sees. This brings me directly to what is on the right side. So on the right side, is a distinguisher between game 0 and game 1. And this distinguisher at the end outputs a decisional bit D. Says, what game am I playing? In the middle, we have a reduction. And now what is the interaction? I know this is a lot of memory. We have to memorize how these games work, what are the inputs and what are the outputs. This is just exercise for you. It also took me as a student, it took me a while to remember what are the inputs, what are the outputs, but the more often I see them, the less I have to think about the syntactics, the more I can think about the meaning. So, what are the inputs, what are the outputs of the distinguisher, of the reduction, of the IND game? You can answer to any of those. Anyone? Yes, please.
The reduction has to input it to IND.
That's the very last thing. Okay, so the challenge is some kind of some xi, and this is just an input to the pseudorandom function. So internally, the game begins with sampling a key, specifying some bookkeeping variable. And then what is the output to the oracle that takes this input xi? We call it yi, but the interesting part is how is yi calculated? Yes, please. Yes. So we just do it slightly different today, but yes. So if b equals 0, then yi is f of k comma xi. And otherwise, from the set of possible outputs, exactly. But for this, we make sure that our bookkeeping works. So if q of xi is still not defined, then we define this value by sampling it from all possible outputs. And if we did that, then yi is just q of xi. And the game eventually stops with the attacker's output. What does the distinguisher on the right side see? What are the inputs? What are the outputs? I think in the interest of time, I'm a bit faster now. So the distinguisher on the right side just sees what an adversary in the game would just normally see. It has some tag oracle where the attacker can input messages mi and receives back tags ti. And the attacker can regularly ask for message tag pairs MJ, tag J, and receive back result delta J. Now, what's the reduction doing here? How are these things simulated? Yes, please.
Xi is just mi.
Tau I is just yi. Very good, thank you. What do we do with the verification requests? No worries, we're coming closer, but yeah. Yes, exactly. So we just do the same. We just say that x q plus j. So we just separate the first axis and the second axis. If we think that I is in q, and then if yq plus j equals tj, then delta q delta j equals 0 equals 1. Else delta J is set to 0. So finally, what's the output of the reduction? Yes, please.
A question, could you explain why we have this Q plus J?
Just for encoding. The reason is that I don't want to confuse the first queries with the second queries. So the attacker, the way we define our SUF CMA game, has two oracles. One oracle for asking for tags for specific messages, and the other one for verifying whether message and tags belong together. The first batch here is just directly forwarded to the IND game. The response is also forwarded to the distinguisher. The second batch here is also just directly forwarded to the IND game, but in order to say that these messages are not confused with these inputs outputs here, I will just start a second batch, and the separator is Q. And whatever Q is, I could also interleave those things, but I wouldn't have to. I just want to specify an encoding from the number of queries here to the number of queries here. Does that make sense, roughly? Exactly. It's just about matching these indices here to these indices there. So at the end, the number of queries with mi here plus the number of queries mj here equals the number of queries xi here. So I have to put two sets of queries into one set of queries. And I separate them by just making sure that I assume these queries here are Q queries, and those here, they just start with Q. So, is a set. It's a set. The set of 1 to Q. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to Q.
Is that a min?
it's an interval from 1 to q, but I just say that this is, yeah, the set of all numbers, of all integers from 1 to q. Yeah, but it's very important to repeat it to everybody else. That was the reason why I'm saying it loud. So, how do I derive this bit here, bit b prime? Yes, please. Thank you. So, the result of this, just as a sketch, is that the advantage of an attacker playing either game 1 or game 0 and trying to identify which of both is played is less equal the advantage of an attacker playing the IND game against the PRF and then in game 1 A can only win the strong unforgeability game under chosen message attacks if it guesses a random tag correctly. This means that the advantage of an attacker in game G1 is just Q verify over the size of set Y or size of space Y, where Q verify is the number of queries to Oracle verify and Y is the pseudorandom function's output space. And in total, we have that the advantage of an attacker against the MAC in the SUF CMA game is less equal than the advantage of deciding in which of the two games an attacker is, either game 0 or game 1, plus the advantage of an attacker in playing against game 1. And this is the same as or less equal the advantage of winning in the IND game against the pseudorandom function plus Q verify over the size of the output space of the pseudorandom function. Yes, absolutely. The weakness of this construction, or the problem of this construction, is that the message space is limited to the input space of the pseudonym function. That means that we can so far only produce message MAC tags for messages of bounded length. We would like to do this for long messages. And for this reason, we have the CBC MAC. And you can find out more about this in the Katzlindel book on pages 122 following. And the CBC MAC is specified in RFC 3601. As part of the CCM mode. The counter mode with CBC MAC. So the guarantee or the property that this CBC MAC gives us is that it produces message tags for long messages. And the idea is basically that we split the message into multiple chunks, and we use a pseudorandom function . So the idea of the CBC MAC is that we begin to input the length of the message that we want to authenticate into the pseudorandom function. The output of the pseudorandom function is then XORed with the first block of the message. And this XOR sum is then input to the pseudorandom function again. The output is then again XORed with the next block of the message, and so on and so forth. The final output is the tag. And the security of this message authentication code is given if the pseudorandom function is IND secure.
there a reason that we don't just use hash functions if we want unlimited or larger message space?
That's the typical way we do it. Well, that's often a way we do it in practice. But hash functions internally also have some internal structure to process multiple chunks of blocks. So one way would be the sponge construction. Another one would be the Merkle-Damgard constructions. And at the end, there is no large advantage in using either or the other, because essentially at the end, it depends on what we use as the pseudorandom function or what we use as the compression function for hash functions, and whether the system that we use has hardware acceleration for either of those things. Okay, any questions about message authentication codes? Yes.
When repeating this F under K,
yeah,
n times, do you get a melioration of the whole system? So
a what?
You get an effect, a detrimental effect on the whole thing when iterating this function over and over again.
You mean whether things become more efficient if I repeat it multiple times, like if I can pre-compute things?
You lose security.
No, no. I don't lose security. Pseudorandom functions give me security.
Repetition.
Yeah. So let me think for a second. If I forget any, corner case. I don't think so. I think the only way that there could be an attack, there could be a problem, is that there happens a collision inside, like due to the repetition. So if at some point I produce an input to the pseudorandom function that I produced before already, because at that point I can just cut things or repeat things arbitrarily often, but I believe that in the proof, this will appear. So you will have some kind of a birthday bound that appears in your advantage term. But as long as the pseudorandom function has long enough input space and long enough output space, and since the pseudorandom function's output is indistinguishable from random, the probability of a collision should be small, negligible. Yeah. I guess that's the only problem that can occur if you repeat this multiple times. Yeah. But you can just imagine if you have a reduction, you want to prove security for this thing, then your attacker just inputs a long message and you internally as the reduction will just chunk this message into multiple bits, multiple blocks, and you will just ask your IND game for the pseudorandom function with all these blocks, get back, and you will do this actually iteratively because you will always XOR the previous output with the next input block, will again ask the pseudorandom function, and the only outcome that you will have that your reduction has the number of blocks, more queries to the underlying security game of the PRF, then you are queried from the attacker against the message authentication code. So in principle, the only thing that can happen is that you have a collision in the input slash output space. Okay, that was message authentication codes. The main tools for which message authentication codes are used are authenticated encryption schemes. And since it is pretty much for free, authenticated encryption is typically defined as authenticated encryption with associated data. So we can add more data that is associated to a message or a ciphertext that is not encrypted. So what's the idea of message authentication codes? We have, again, users Alice and Bob. We have, again, an adversary sitting on the wire. And Alice wants to send a ciphertext to Bob. And in this case, she produces the ciphertext by encrypting with the previous shared key a message, and possibly she has some associated data AD that she just wants to connect as context information to the message and the ciphertext. And then Bob receives the ciphertext. He uses the same key. He takes the ciphertext from the network, and he has maybe some associated data on his side. And then the output of this decryption algorithm is either the real message or an explicit rejection symbol. And the idea of that is that Bob only accepts ciphertexts that were sent by Alice if they have not been manipulated and if Alice and Bob share the same associated data. So the syntax is that we have a gen algorithm that an input nothing probabilistically outputs a key symbol or a key element. The encryption algorithm takes a key, a message, and some associated data, and probabilistically outputs a ciphertext. And the decryption algorithm on input of a key, associated data, and a ciphertext outputs either a message or a rejection symbol that we call here the bottom symbol. Correctness. How do we define correctness? Thank you. And this should hold for all keys generated with gen,
This does not follow our syntax. It did follow our syntax. Sorry. All associated data. all messages in our message space and all associated data strings in our associated data space. So, what type of security guarantees would we like to have from AEAD, so authenticated encryption with associated data? What type of guarantees would we like to have? Mm-hmm. This will be the result, but we can require it slightly differently. Yeah, and, but continue first. We definitely want strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks. So we want to make sure that it is hard for an attacker to produce ciphertexts that have not been produced by the victims, honestly. But if we have strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks, we don't have also, we don't need to require IND CCA security. Because
the decryption will reject it anyway.
The decryption will be rejected by the strong unforgeability already, which means that it suffices to require IND CPA security. Exactly. So we want that it offers IND CPA security and strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks. So just to exercise one of these two examples, we will just adapt the strong unforgeability definition here for authenticated encryption. You can do the same for IND CPA security very easily. So the attacker can query for messages and associated data strings and receives ciphertexts. Internally, the game generates a key, and then for all ciphertexts, it just encrypts the message associated data pairs with the real key. Then we do bookkeeping. And the attacker can send messages, associated data strings and ciphertexts. And receive back no. The attacker can send associated data strings and ciphertexts. And then internally,
the game decrypts, these associated data strings and ciphertexts. And the question is, under which condition does the attacker win?
Any of this, like wallet? So it's not this.
Bot symbol, yeah. This is one condition. This is a good condition, but it's not all conditions yet.
It shouldn't be in queue.
What shouldn't be in queue? Yes. Exactly. So the advantage that we defined for an AAD scheme in the SUF-CMA game is just the probability that this game outputs one. And the advantage of breaking the security of an AEAD scheme is just the advantage of breaking its IND-CPA security. Plus the advantage in breaking its strong unforgeability and a chosen message attack security. And as a side effect, we will see that IND CPA security plus strong unforgeability and a chosen message attacks suffices to yield IND CCA security. And this will be an exercise. Okay. Of course, we want to build authenticated encryption. And just the way we define security for authenticated encryption, we also built authenticated encryption. We built it generically from encryption without authentication and message authentication codes. So there are basically three ways of building or composing encryption and message authentication codes. The first one is encrypt and MAC. So the ciphertext is just defined as the encryption under some key K1 and the message, and this is just concatenated with a tag under key 2. Produced for the message and the associated data string. The second alternative is MAC then encrypt. So we first MAC the message and the associated data string, and then both of that message, associated data string, and the tag are encrypted. So we encrypt under K1 the message and the tag under K2 with the message and the associated data string. Does anyone know anything? Like, we will see a third construction in a second, but does anyone know anything about these two constructions? Yes, please. So it will be part of the exercise to show that they are not generically secure. So even if your encryption scheme is INDCPA secure and your message authentication code is strongly unforgeable, then there exist encryption schemes that are INDCPA secure and message authentication codes that are strongly unforgeable, such that this construction, both of these constructions, either of these constructions, none of these constructions, provide security in the sense that we require it from authenticated encryption schemes. The only construction that provides generic security is encrypt then MAC. What I still want to add here, and we will hear about this later, there are constructions that use encrypt and MAC, and there are constructions that use message MAC then encrypt. For certain combinations of tags and encryption schemes that offer security. So specifically, for certain specific tuples of encryption scheme and message authentication code, one can provide security with these compilers. But generically, if you do not specify which tag to compose with which encryption scheme, you can come up with problems such that you have attacks. So if you try to build a secure AAD scheme and you didn't fully analyze whether they fit together, then you should use the encrypt then MAC paradigm. And the last part that we do today is just build an encrypt then MAC scheme. So given a symmetric encryption scheme, gen, eng, and dec prime, and a message authentication code given named gen prime prime tag and verify. We could also just say no, I think that's okay. Then our gen algorithm produces an encryption key by using the symmetric encryption scheme's gen algorithm. It produces a message authentication code key by using its gen algorithm. And then it returns both keys as the combined key. The encryption algorithm on input of the key, the message, and associated data first passes the key, deriving its two components, encryption key and MAC key. Then it encrypts the message using the encryption key. And then it produces the tag using the MAC key. Taking as input the associated data and the ciphertext. And the final output is the ciphertext and the tag. The decryption algorithm on input of the key, the associated data string, and the ciphertext again splits the key into the encryption key and the MAC key. It splits the ciphertext into the encryption ciphertext and the message authentication code. Then it first verifies using the MAC key whether associated data string or ciphertext have been manipulated. And otherwise, if it has not been manipulated, the decryption of the ciphertext is output. In which line?
After the
decryption. In the second line that is visible.
Given.
Given as yes, of course. Thank you. No, no, no. Yeah, thank you very much. Those typos are ugly, especially if we record all of that. Thank you. Okay, so this is almost the end of symmetric encryption or symmetric cryptography in total. Next week we will have the transition to asymmetric cryptography. So Alice and Bob have different components of keys, and we will see how digital signatures are built. And we will actually directly jump into the topic by seeing a post-quantum secure digital signature scheme, the Lampert signature scheme. We will have some final remarks on authenticated encryption at the beginning of next week, but this will basically end the chapter of symmetric cryptography. Thank you very much for attending and listening today, and I see you next week.